Good morning. Welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm your host, Bella Johnson. In Sacred Dying, a book written by author Megory Anderson, who is a theologian and founder of the Sacred Dying Foundation, guides readers into the use of personalized and creative rituals to help loved ones die a peaceful and sacred death. As we're in the cycle of Scorpio right now, which is very much about death and regeneration, I thought this an apropos topic to discuss on today's show. Megory draws on teaching and techniques from all faiths and beliefs, and her book shows how to create sacred surroundings, let go of past hurts, anger, guilt, and fear, how to allow death to happen with acceptance and peace, and how to create a celebration of faith during the final moments of life. The Sacred Dying Foundation, which has a website at www.sacreddying.org, exists because, as she says, we in Western society do not know how to die well. We are caught between medicine and technology, which very valiantly and wonderfully do their jobs of saving lives, but are not at all conducive to allowing grace and dignity when it is time for a person to die. Further, returning the sacred to the act of dying can be and oftentimes must be a one-on-one act. Each individual death must be honored as a life transition rather than as a medical failure or an embarrassment to the family. Being present for those going through this transition is our work and our highest calling. Sacred dying is as simple as being present with a loved member of our family and as complicated as transforming the vision of our entire society. Megory's Foundation, and again I've been quoting from the Foundation website, it was created in 1996 by Megory Anderson and seeks to serve those who are at the point of death and to educate the public on new models of death and dying for our society. With that, I'd like to welcome Megory Anderson, guest for today's show. Hi, Megory.
Good morning.
There you are, bright and early.
Yes.
I'd like to talk first on this societal view of death, the cultural view that we share, not necessarily embrace, on death and dying. Can you speak on that?
I think during the past 100 years, we've made a shift from death taking place within the family, within the home, to relegating it to the medical community. And the medical community is about fixing, it's about healing, it's about curing. And when it comes to death and dying, I think physicians, medical people tend to see death as failure, that they haven't been able to do their job. And they don't quite know what to do with that. So those who are dying are taken away to die quietly, apart from everybody else, often alone. And that's where we've left it. It's created a fear of dying. It's created a real apprehension about allowing death to be a natural part of our lives.
You mentioned dying, many that die alone. And there are a couple of things I want to address on that that were brought up in the book. One is how people help those dying alone. And the other is actually when it seems that the dying person is choosing to die alone, when the last person who's been vigiling with them leaves the room and the person dies and the survivors regret forever that they were not there. So those are two probably separate but I think related questions, if you could address those. Yeah.
There was a survey done not too long ago about death and dying, and people were asked what their biggest fear was, and one of them was dying alone. you know, alone in a hospital. And unfortunately, that's where most of our deaths take place, in the hospital alone. That's how we do things. And I think for the most part, people don't want isolation. They may choose to want solitude towards the end, but not isolation. And those are two very, very different things. I know of a number of families who have been very much present with their loved one, and the minute that they go off and leave the person for just a few moments to get coffee or to just catch up on some sleep, the dying person will choose at that point in solitude to die. But that's very, very different from being abandoned. Very different. And unfortunately, most people, I think, are abandoned when it comes time to face their death.
So how can someone who's perhaps not a family member even, how can we as caring people facilitate these kinds of passings? How can we get involved, those of us feeling called to do this kind of work? How can we get involved in helping these many, many people who are dying in hospitals alone?
Well, there are possibilities. I mean, we can do volunteer work, for instance, at hospice. And hospice is a wonderful organization that's devoted to allowing dignity at death, allowing the space to die relatively pain-free, we always hope, many, many times in the comfort of home rather than being left in the hospital. So hospice is a wonderful organization that accepts volunteers. So we can often place ourselves in organizations like that. Assistants and chaplains to go to hospitals and volunteer some time in the chaplain's office and just sitting and being present with those who are dying. It's a major, major role in our society.
Yes, which leads to the topic of vigiling. Mm-hmm. Can you describe this and expand on that?
What I've done is recognize that the last few hours, the last day, is extremely important. Usually the person is floating in and out of consciousness. But there are many issues. Oftentimes a person, unfortunately, leaves unfinished business until the very end. You know, there's a fear involved in dying and a denial. But when those last days come, it just hits very, very powerfully that they're going to die. And all of a sudden, all this work is in front of them. So what I will do is go to the bedside of the dying and do a combination of maybe some rituals, some last rites, provide a sense of the sacred during this transition. And a lot of times just sitting in silence, just being a presence at the deathbed, which is equally as important. Not so much doing things, but just being present and allowing that spiritual flow to take place.
Well, a lot of what I think that spiritual flow is about is just being able to love someone. And I love the quote that you placed in your book from Rainer Maria Rilke. We need in love to practice only this, letting each other go. For holding on comes easily. We do not need to learn it. You also spoke in your book to the family, which, when present, surrounds the bedside of the dying person and either denies that that person is, in fact, going to die. And why don't we talk about that first, and then I'll give you the mm-hmm. second portion of that question. What do we do with denial?
That's a hard one, because you've got two issues going on. You've got the family who might be in denial. Usually at that point in the stage, the last few days before death, the dying person knows that this is happening. He or she can feel it in his body. The soul is beginning to make that separation from the body. It's a process. Once it starts, I'm sure that it's very, very evident to the dying person. But family members trying to hang on, you know, everything's going to be just fine. But that's not always the case. And sometimes I have to pull the family members outside and just be very blunt and say, now's the time. It's time to be present. It's time to help your mother, your father, go through this. Can you do it? And sometimes just the shock of realizing this is happening now will be enough. Will be enough.
And the second part of the question is when the family members begin to discuss in the presence of the dying person things which are best left outside of that room.
Yes. One of my biggest concerns is that we've taken the experience of dying away from the person, that it becomes about the survivors. How am I going to deal with this? What's happening? How is it going to affect me? And that's a hard one because obviously the survivors are going through this experience also. But it's the dying person's experience first and foremost. So, again, a lot of times I have to be blunt. I've walked into hospital rooms where siblings are arguing over who's going to get the silver when mother dies. And even though mother is floating in and out of consciousness or even may be in a coma, it doesn't matter. A lot of our scriptural texts from the religious traditions talk about the deathbed room as being sacred, and you have to honor that sacredness. And discussing the silver is not something that's sacred. And so I ask them to leave. I will ask them to leave until they can work out whatever difficulties they have and come back and focus in on their loved one's death. That's a hard one, but I think it's important.
You addressed also when someone has passed on and a person is too far away, this has either been sudden or it's just circumstances have occurred that have prevented a person from getting near to that loved one when they pass. I like what you had to say. I like the steps that you talked about, how to deal with that when you have heard that a person who has died.
We're not often given the opportunity to be at the deathbed. You know, probably 9 times out of 10, we're not able to be present, that we hear about the death from another place. And whether it's 5 minutes away or 500 miles away, there are things that we can do. And also, whether it's been 5 minutes or it's been perhaps 5 days, I think one of the things to remember is that death is fluid. I found out in all the deaths that I've been present at is that the body doesn't shut down 1 minute and that's it. Certainly the doctor can proclaim that death has occurred at a certain specific time. But I think that the soul tends to be present, kind of going back and forth in a very fluid way. Certainly before the death, I've seen people kind of with one foot in life and one foot in death, and certainly after death. A lot of religious traditions teach that the soul hovers after death for sometimes days, and that we have access to that soul, that we can connect in some way. So I ask people to find the connecting points, whether it be a photograph or an article of clothing, and use that connecting point to do whatever you need to do to help reconcile with that person, to finish unfinished business, and then to let the soul go on.
Can you describe some of these steps that you mention in the book under the subchapter distance, or the subtitle distance, mm-hmm. about taking the quiet time to connect and so on, so that people kind of are familiar with those?
Well, again, it's finding a connecting place and finding just a specific item, because it's easier for us to focus on something specific. We have an article of clothing or a photograph in front of us, and use that as kind of a proxy for the person. And I recommend that people find a really quiet, calm place, a prayerful place, and use that where it's just the two of you, and really ask the soul to be present, you know, to ask that person to come, say, in that photograph, to come be with you so that you can communicate. You can finish what you need to finish and say what you need to say to the person. It does work. And if you talk to your loved one, if you just say all the things that you would have said had you been present at that person's death or before that person's death, really take advantage of that moment when you learn of the death. And it helps you, and it certainly helps the soul of the person who has just died. I've recommended that people say a blessing to bless the life of the person who's just died. Pray. Certainly there are prayers for the commendation of the soul. And then to somehow visualize cutting the cord. I talk about that kind of spiritual umbilical cord that connects a person to this life. And to make that separation, to visualize cutting that cord and letting the soul move on and to do what it needs to do and go where it needs to go next.
Okay, another of these that you haven't spoken to or it hasn't been clear to me is recalling the person's life and how much it meant to you, and then doing something symbolic for the person who just died.
Mm-hmm. And that can be anything from saying a prayer, or just taking that photograph and after you bless it, putting it away, putting it in a very special place, or even a place of honor where you can pay homage to it. But finding a symbol, putting a flower in front of it, finding whatever symbol works for your understanding of that person and his or her life, and honoring the life and then allowing it to let go and to move on.
I liked what you said. I'll quote from the book, "Do something symbolic for the person who has just died. If he loves to garden, sit in the garden and get your hands in the dirt. Mm-hmm. Plant something, dig up something. The symbolic gesture will be meaningful for both of you." So I liked that piece. And you also mention altars, which is kind of what I think we were bridging into when you were talking about doing something symbolic, maybe putting it the picture in a certain place. Can you speak to the altars a little bit? Because I think sometimes that's a little frightening to people, thinking that it's some hokey thing or some kind of, I think altars make people uncomfortable at times.
And they don't need to. Depending on what tradition that you come from, they can either be a very positive image or they can be kind of scary. An altar doesn't need to be anything more than just a shelf, a little table, something in the corner that can hold special objects for you, so that when you approach it or spend some time in front of it, they recall something special and something sacred. People will put photographs on altars. They will put special symbolic objects, something that's reminiscent of the person who has just died, flowers, religious objects, put a cross on it, perhaps put, oh, a piece of cloth. It's a place set apart that when your eye goes to it, it brings something special to you, visually, emotionally, and through the sacred.
Now, a couple of things this brings up is talking, as you did earlier in the book, about imagery and how important images and imagery are to both the dying person as well as the surviving.
Right. In hospital rooms, I don't know the last time you were in a hospital, but they tend to be pretty dreary. And the central focus is usually the television. If people can bring in special objects from home, anything from pieces of cloth to photographs to drawings to special religious pictures, beautiful pictures of nature, that can help. Because when a person is dying, they kind of latch on to things in the room. They will notice things, and that will help them to recall loved ones. It will help them to create a sense of peacefulness in the room. So visual objects are very, very important. And I often ask families to bring in things from home that have some meaning.
Now, mentioning religion, a lot of times you say, and I have experienced, that people move away from the faith that they grew up with. But one thing I'd like you to address is bringing that back as an option to the dying person, because you say so often they go back to those early roots, even though they have been severed from them.
Yes. It's very, very interesting. Well, first of all, I think physically, when a person is dying, they tend to revert to childhood. A lot of their memories are childhood memories. You'll often see people curled up in a fetal position the last day or two of their life. It's what I call Sunday school religion. What we were taught as a young child, it tends to stick. And those symbols, the prayers, the symbols about afterlife, the comforting scriptures, tend to be ones that have a great deal of meaning. And I certainly met with many people who tell me, well, you know, I grew up going to a Presbyterian church for a few years, and then I stopped going, and then I became a Buddhist in college, and now I'm not really doing much of anything. But I find that those early symbols are the ones that do stick and then tend to bring a lot of comfort. So I'll ask and find that, for instance, if they grew up Catholic, to have the rosary being said or the 23rd Psalm, bring in some beads. It's very meaningful.
We want to take a break soon. I'm kind of looking through my notes here, and I'd like to take a break and just identify who you are, what we're reading, and the station, but first read an excerpt from your book. In the back of Megory's book, Sacred Dying, there are things that can be read in a room with someone dying, from scriptures and sacred texts to poetry and prayers. There's quite a little collection at the end of the book. This is by Al-Ghazali. Know, beloved, that we cannot understand the future world until we know what death is. And we cannot know what death is until we know what life is. Nor can we understand what life is until we know what the Spirit is, the seat of the knowledge of God. We've been speaking with Megory Anderson, author of Sacred Dying, published by Prima. And you are listening to Alternative Currents, host Bella Johnson on WERU-FM 89.9 in Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor. We'll be back after a short break.
Softly she comes, whispers the breeze with her passing. In secret love she is laughing. Softly she comes in the night. Softly she sighs, sweetly she lies, never sleeping. Her fragrance all in my keeping. Softly she comes in the night. Down the darkened hall I hear her footsteps on my stairs, and she is in my arms once more. Then softly she goes, her shining lips in the shadows. Whisper goodbye at my window. Softly she goes in the dawn. Down the darkened hall I hear her footsteps on my stairs. Softly she goes, her shining lips in the shadows. Whisper goodbye at my window. Softly she goes in the dawn. Softly she goes in the dawn.
And that was Gordon Lightfoot. Welcome back to Alternative Currents. And know that you can call in during the second portion of the program and ask questions of Megory Anderson, author of Sacred Dying, and someone who vigils and is present for the dying. She's a theologian, author, educator, and liturgist. So you may call 469-0500 or 866-625-9378 toll free. We do have a caller right off, Mary Ann. Speak to us. Marianne?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hello. I missed the beginning of the program. I kind of caught in the middle. My question concerns how folks with Alzheimer's experience or are aware of their dying, or are they, if they, what is their dying process? A very dear aunt is no longer in the same plane of understanding as we are, and we don't know what's happening for her.
Now, my experience, and fortunately, I think more and more people have Alzheimer's. I've seen many cases, and it's so hard for both the family and the person going through this. My guess is that up until the time when they're actually dying, they're pretty oblivious to what's happening around them. As you said, they're living in kind of another plane. But when it becomes close, they are aware because something's happening to them physically.
Mm-hmm.
And my experience has been that most of them usually find themselves saying, I want to go home. And not quite knowing what home is, but knowing that they're not at home and uh-huh. they're in the process of leaving somehow. So I usually go with that symbol of saying, okay, let's get ready. Let's find a way that we can help you go home and find the symbols, that images that work for them. A going away party. Special objects in their life to give to them, to say, well, here's a present for when you go, so that they feel something secure, they feel something familiar, to alleviate their fears. But it's hard to be conscious and logical about this, because they don't think logically. They don't have, their brain isn't working in the same way. So find the symbols that work, and it's usually about going home and connecting with loved ones, you know, seeing their mother again or seeing their spouse again, mm-hmm. that sort of thing.
Well, thank you. That helps.
Okay.
Hi.
Thanks, Marianne. Anybody else who would like to call in and speak with Megory Anderson, author of Sacred Dying, published by Prima, and founder of Sacred Dying Foundation, which can be looked up on the net, www.sacreddying.org. Please call in and speak with her. And we are waiting for another caller here. Again, this is Alternative Currents you're listening to on WERU FM 89.9 or 102.9, Harold.
Yeah, I've walked away from the radio, so I don't hear what you say, except as I might hear it over the phone. I think there's a range of, I'm old enough to have had many experiences with death, and the one that I was most intimately involved with over a period of time, it was my wife, and she was terribly insulted by the kind of platitudes and the things that were said, assuming that her Methodist Baptist background was somehow something that she felt that she had certainly outgrown, and that she had an intelligence and that she had a right to have a determination about her own death, and it was being denied to her, and it caused her the kind of great pain that beyond what the morphine was going to do. It was an incredible amount of, I have now been deprived of a right to make a determination that I no longer feel that this is the kind of life I want and that I should be able to just terminate it. And I think that not only for her, but also for the living, that's the kind of service that we deny the dying. And I think that trying to cover it up in other kinds of platitudes and talking about what happens after they die and using words like passing away and passing over, it's a very emotional area for me, and I think that we do the dying a terrible disservice by now allowing them that choice.
It's very difficult these days. We don't do death and dying very well at all. We don't know how to handle it emotionally, spiritually, and because technology has allowed human beings to live a lot longer, I think, than they really ought to be living. We keep people alive way past the time when they should comfortably die. We just don't know how to make those decisions and allow people to die with dignity.
And certainly we should know one way is the way she, as my wife said, I had no problem when my dog was no longer being comfortable. I saw how easy it was to allow the dog to die comfortably. And yet, I am not given the same kind of choice as I see myself deteriorating and wish to have that option. Whether I use it or not was not important. But the kind of torture she would have with each ache and pain not knowing where it was going to go and knowing that it was not going to be in her control to say, I've had enough.
It's something that more and more people are being faced with, and we just don't know what to do with it.
Well, I know that the platitudes that they try to give her were insulting, and I think that making the assumption that telling her she's going to go to another place or all these other terminologies and attempts to be comfortable, none of them replace the idea of somebody saying, the doctor, when you want it, we can discuss it, and if you really want to die with some dignity, we certainly have the technicians who can make sure that it happens, and it happens easily.
Thank you, Harold, for calling. We do have another caller, actually callers waiting, so I'm going to cut you short, but thank you so much for calling in, and we will talk about this more if we have time. Kaylee.
Hi. I have a response to the last caller. I just finished reading Ken Wilber's Grace and Grit, which very much deals with this issue of how we treat the dying, and I highly recommend it. It's a book that's written by a husband and wife. She's dying, and it's both of their experience of how they're received in the world, not only by friends and family, but by the whole community at large, how people respond and place blame on the dying, more or less trying to make them feel responsible for their, not only their, the choices that they make in terms of their religions or their medical choices, but also in getting a terminal illness. So it was really quite amazing to watch this woman in her early 40s, to read about her coming to terms with that and to move so far beyond it and to open to her own dying in such an amazing way and the challenges. And they've written quite a bit of stuff around that issue, so you might want to check that out.
Well, another book that comes to mind immediately that I was madly trying to do sign language with my engineer, Helen, and she came up with the title by Helen and Scott Nearing was Leaving the Good Life. He made a choice to die by limiting his intake of food until he basically, like she said, passed like a leaf in the wind.
But, you know, I think it might have been a little different for Scott Nearing because he was so old at that point.
Yes.
There's a lot of forgiveness about a very old person dying. You know, he was in his 90s.
And it's much harder when somebody is younger.
Yes.
It almost is like the person dying makes other people uncomfortable. And there's a guilt involved with that. And certainly within our society, we don't know what to do with younger people who are not in their elderly years, dying. We just don't know what to do with that, and it makes us very uncomfortable.
Well, the other point I wanted to make was 11 years ago, my husband and I had a baby who died, and at that point, it was mind-blowing, of course. It was such a shock and so hard for us on so many levels, but there was also a lot of really beautiful healing that happened in our life because of this baby coming in and going out. But the people around us, even some of the people in our fairly close community, there was a tremendous sense of shame and guilt and bewilderment because of the way we were received from that point on by people who couldn't handle it, didn't know how to deal with us. And it was very informative. It certainly changed the way I am in the world. I feel much more open and loving and compassionate than I think I was before that experience, because I can see how much fear we walk around with, how afraid we are to love one another and to feel the ability to reach out and say, look, I'm scared because of what happened to you or what's happening to you, and how can I be there for you?
Okay. Thank you very much, Kaylee. We'll open the lines to other callers. Again, 469-0500 or toll-free 866-625-9378. Megory, would you speak to some of the preparations that a person can make kind of from the beginning of your book about preparing sacred space and how one actually surrounds the dying in this way, regardless of where they are?
Yes, I think it's very important. If you have somebody who is dying over a period of time, either in a hospital, a nursing home, or at home, to recognize first and foremost that this is a sacred experience, that this is a transition, that this is something very, very special that the person is going through. And physical space plays a huge role. I've walked into many rooms where it's just chaos, where it's dirty. There are medicine bottles around. There's dirty dishes. Things are very haphazard. Creating sacred space can change everything. I recommend that people clean, of having space around them be tidy, uncluttered. I recommend that we contain the space. For instance, if a person is in the hospital with another room, to do what you can to create borders around that so that you don't bring in another person's energy, that you don't bring in outside clutter, that you make the space as contained as possible. You can bring in flowers. You can set up an altar. You can bring in photographs. Can bring in peaceful pictures. Music is important, I think. Not all the time, but to have it available when you want to have sounds around you that are sacred. There are many things that you can do, but recognizing that the death bedroom is indeed a sacred space.
What about the person who wants to leave the hospital and die at home? How receptive are hospitals to this happening?
If you connect up with hospice, they're very receptive. And the key thing is to get the referral from the physician and say, I want to be at home. How can you help facilitate that? And I think hospice is the best way to do that. They have a whole system in place where they help with hospital beds and any other items that you may need. And they have nurses, social workers, chaplains, as well as volunteers to help you create a space at home to be able to die at home.
Again, we're speaking with Megory Anderson, author of Sacred Dying, and I'll invite you to call in at 469-0500 or toll-free 866-625-9378. Megory, what do we do when someone is terrified of the afterlife, either because they lack a religious or spiritual conviction, or because in spite of that, they're still absolutely terrified of death?
That's a hard one. In our society, I think the Judeo-Christian understanding of heaven and hell is very strong. And even if you aren't participants in a faith tradition that talks about this, that's kind of the overlying understanding that we're either going to go to heaven or hell. And people have guilt over what they've done in their lives. Times when they've done something wrong, when they've hurt somebody. You know, we're all human. We don't do things the way that we want them to be done. I try to honor a person's faith and beliefs, but when we start talking about hell and punishment and you know, God's going to get me for all the bad things that I've done, I tend to do two things. Certainly confession, certainly just unburdening themselves is important. Just get it all out and then talk about reconciliation, talk about forgiveness. And then I then I ask people to find the place inside of them where the love is. And that may be the love of a spouse, a love of children. Find the place where the love is and go there. And that's where they're headed, to the place where the love is. And it usually calms people down. I don't talk about punishment. I don't talk about retribution. I really do believe that the place in the afterlife is a place of love.
What about someone who experiences a great deal of anger, feeling betrayal at perhaps God?
Again, get it out. Let it go. Find ways, find rituals to tear something up, to destroy something, to burn something. Find a way to get it out, because it doesn't belong inside of you. And again, that's difficult, especially for people dying young. If you're 40 years old and have children who have yet to grow up, and you realize that you don't have very long, there's a lot of anger in that, of not being able to live out your life. Express the anger. See it as something that's just toxic for you, and find a way to get it out. And then find peacefulness in its place.
And addressing fear as the hidden part of that anger.
Mm-hmm. They're very much related, the fear and the anger. And sometimes it means ranting at God and allowing a space for that. God, who's in control of all of this. We go through a lot of emotions. And any good therapist or any good psychologist will tell you that it's not good to have them bottled up, and even more so at the end of life. Again, just get it out however you can. And if it means pounding pillows, tearing or ripping, I've taken hospital sheets and had people just tear them and just name the anger, name the fears with every tear, to find some way of another person holding those fears for you and then taking them away.
Yes, you spoke of the one man who was, I believe he was dying of AIDS, that was so angry at not having his own clothes and not having his own bedding that you found an old blanket somewhere and brought it in and asked him to express that, and also brought him some clothing and asked him to express and release that anger through tearing up that blanket. I thought that was pretty powerful.
And we got permission to take the old hospital gowns, which are just dreadful if you're in the hospital for any length of time. And it was so foreign to him, and he just wanted his own bathrobe, his own pajamas and his flannel bathrobe. We just took that hospital gown and ripped it to shreds, and there was a lot of satisfaction in that.
On the topic of AIDS, I'd really like you to touch on that for a moment, about almost like the lepers of modern day and how that hands-off approach has just really alienated these usually very sensitive beings from the mainstream.
Well, I live in San Francisco, and AIDS is a part of our community. Less so these days, thank goodness. We're not seeing nearly as many deaths from AIDS as we did even 5-6 years ago. But yes, they are lepers, and people glove up and mask up when they come into the room, and they don't like touching. And people who are in their deathbeds want and crave touch. And when you're dying of AIDS, when people are afraid to touch you, even more so. I use oil for massage a lot when I'm with the dying. And to go into a room and massage somebody's arms and legs who has AIDS, it's such a gift, I think, to them. You know, those who have been put away, you know, not allowed to be touched. Just to go in there and say, you deserve to be held, to be touched, to be comforted when you're dying.
And touch for anyone. I think we're a grossly undertouched culture. I have a lot of judgments about touch in general.
Yeah.
Touch briefly, would you? No pun intended. On these musicians that come in and play music for the dying, and or massage therapists or people who come in to do that kind of touching?
More and more people are finding out that that there are organizations and individuals who will do this. There's a wonderful organization called Chalice of Repose out of Missoula, Montana, where they call themselves music thanatologists, thanatology being the study of dying, who use both voice and harp to be present with those who are dying. It's extraordinary to watch film clips of beautiful men and women coming in and playing the harp for an hour at a time at the deathbed. It's just amazing. There's something so wonderful. And I mean, you've heard the phrase, you know, angelic, referred to them before, but it really takes you to another place. Music has an extraordinary power to transport you and to heal and to calm the fears and to calm the anger. So they're training people now in Missoula to learn to be with the dying and then to go out across the country back to their homes.
And again, that is Chalice of Repose. I would imagine you could find them on the internet somewhere for a resource.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned on the topic of sound, people going in and playing for dying people but not being attuned to the fact, first of all, the kind of music that they might want to hear, but also the extreme sensitivity to sound that the dying experience.
Exactly. Those who are dying, everything becomes heightened. The senses become heightened before they start to go. And certainly scent, smell, but also sound. Very, very acutely aware of sounds going around them. And sometimes I'll see very well-intentioned people come in with guitars or some other instruments and think that they're being helpful to the dying, but not realizing that but the kind of sounds, the kind of music that's needed needs to be soothing music, quiet, not stimulating, just the opposite. So I often have to remind people that this is about the dying person and what their needs are. And their needs are for soothing music, for quiet music, for music that can help them relax.
We may have time for one more call if anybody does want to speak with Megory Anderson, author of Sacred Dying, the topic that we're speaking on today, and her book title, 469-0500 or toll-free 866-625-9378 if you're sitting back saying, oh, I'll call, but you want to do that because we just have time for one more call. So while we're waiting for callers, or as we're progressing along here, on touch, you mentioned a little bit about using oils and so on. One of the things I noticed that you mentioned a lot are candles and the atmosphere that the candles set, but also the kind of administering or ministering to that person, about being able to touch them, rub their feet. We do have a call, so I'm distracted now. Let's wait and see for a second here before we get on to that topic. This would be Susan. Speak
hello?
To us. Yeah, hi.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to know if Megory could give information as far as if there's training for this kind of work and what the availability of that is. And I'll hang up and listen.
Yes, more and more opportunities for working with the dying. If you have, for instance, if you're a massage therapist, there are other therapists who do some training, music thanatology at Chalice of Repose. But for actually sitting with the dying, we're just realizing now that people are called to this. Zen Hospice in San Francisco, which is a wonderful, wonderful organization. Frank Ostasevsky was on Oprah yesterday, I noticed.
This is Zen Hospice, you said?
The Zen Hospice in San Francisco is offering a whole training. I think it's a year-long training for what they call midwives for the dying.
And your society, your foundation also provides?
Yes, we're starting to do some training for those who want to do ritual or any other type of sitting with the dying. It's not something that we've done in the past. We haven't known to do it, but are just beginning to realize that there is a need to do dying very differently, and it's time we start training people to help facilitate this.
Any closing remarks, Megory?
As we move closer to our own death, to realize that we can do this differently, that there does need to be a new paradigm for how we die, and that involves bringing the spiritual, bringing religious traditions, bringing cultural traditions into this process, and not letting the medical model, which sees death as failure, take over, because that's not the reality of what's going on.
Well, I want to thank you for being present on Alternative Currents today. You can listen to Alternative Currents every first Friday of the month at 10 a.m. on WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and 102.9 Bangor. This is Ben Bella Johnson, your host, and I'd like to close with a poem or a reading from Megory Anderson's book, Sacred Dying. This is anonymous. When I die, if you need to weep, cry for your brother or sister walking the streets beside you. And when you need me, put your arms around anyone and give them what you need to give me. I want to leave you something, something better than words or sounds. Look for me in the people I've known or loved, and if you cannot give me away, at least let me live in your eyes and not on your mind. You can love me most by letting hands touch hands, by letting bodies touch bodies, and by letting go of children that need to be free. Love doesn't die, people do. So when all that's left of me is love, give me away. Talk to you next month.
Support for WERU comes from